Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Italian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Gary Milligan, your host. Today, we'll be talking to Timothy McCall, the author of Brilliant Bodies, Fashioning Courtly Men in Early Renaissance Italy, which was published earlier this year by the Pennsylvania State University Press. Dr. McCall is Associate Professor of Art History and Director of the Art History Program at Villanova University. He has been the recipient of several fellowships, including long-term residential fellowships at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and at the Harvard University Center for Italian Renaissance Studies at Villa Itati. He's written extensively on men's fashion and sexuality in Renaissance Italy and co-edited the book Visual Cultures of Secrecy in Early Modern Europe. Tim, welcome. Thanks for agreeing to speak with me today. I'm really delighted to have you on the podcast.
Thanks, Gary. I'm super excited to be here and to talk to you in particular about this book.
Yeah, I have to say, for all of you out there listening, this book is exceptionally beautiful. I'm less accustomed to art history books because, you know, literature books are never as pretty as this, but also just substantially large format and heavy, I will add. So definitely a book that's worth having in the physical format, in my opinion. So I'll plug that there.
And if I can add, like, you know, I'm just thrilled to see a lot of Penn State makes beautiful books with lots of color images. But in particular, when I receive them, I didn't know that the end papers would be this bright pink, and that that might be my favorite part of the book.
Oh yeah,
as a thing,
that's a great surprise. Yeah, it's really stunning. So before we dive into the book, I just wanted to ask, what got you interested in writing about men's dress?
Well, it's interesting. So, well, I mean, I find it interesting. I sort of use it, I think, as an object lesson, also to talk to students. Where I wrote my dissertation on these lords around Parma and the frescoes that they, that one lord in particular commissioned, frescoes that, including frescoes related depicting the Griselda cycle, right? A different version, certainly slightly different than Boccaccio or Petrarch's versions of the story, and then another sort of chivalric frescoed room. There are interesting ideas that about gender that obviously that, you know, that the Griselda cycle engages with, and this sort of this other fresco cycle at Torre Chiara, a little south of Parma, that has to do with chivalric love. So I was interested in mistresses and gender more broadly, but mainly looking at women. And it was one of those things that sort of like when I had a little distance, and I mean, this is 15 or more years ago now, but when I had maybe a year or two away from my dissertation, I realized what actually I was talking about or needed to be talking about was masculinity and was men. And so I started moving in that direction. And I mean, I just realized that a lot of the assumptions that people had been making about these lords and about their display and about their adornment. And in particular, jewelry and clothing were, I think, sort of overlaid with our own assumptions too much about the way that fashion is gendered. And I think that's something that we'll talk about today. But I realized, and then when I first started this, I gave a conference paper at the Renaissance Society of America, and I got pushback on some of the claims I was making. And it made me realize I needed to sort of like really do a deep dive into this. And then, you know, so I don't know, 10 years later, this is what's emerged. The book is hopefully full of interesting and beautiful things and hopefully some insightful insights hopefully lots of intelligent insights. But at the same time too, I really want it to be something that can apply to people thinking critically about masculinity and fashion, even if they're not interested in the 15th century. But of course, you know, particularly for those who are interested in the 15th century.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you and I beat the same drum about the modern assumptions about masculinity. And your book challenging those assumptions is definitely where we're going to be heading, I think, in this conversation. So let's start. Even with the title, you discuss clothes and bodies of men from the 1400s and tell us that there's an emphasis on brilliance. So, and the title of the book is Brilliant Bodies. So let's start there. What does brilliance mean, and how is it expressed in clothing?
Well, yeah, so the title is, you know, nicely alliterative. Both of these words are super important, right? This study in a lot of ways is a study of bodies and of embodiment. And there's certainly been a move towards that. I'm sure some listeners will be familiar with in the humanities of all sorts of studies of embodiment. But what really struck me, and I think this is one of those things that scholars of my field kind of like might not have intentionally thought about, but what, you know, it's very familiar to them now that I've kind of said it, was the extent to which brilliance and radiance and splendor, all of these words that sort of capture Renaissance or aristocracy relate to light. And even one like polish or pulito, right, which in Italian generally now means clean, but in this period very much related to light, to polish, and also to sort of class distinctions, right, that we still have with the word polite. And so that fundamentally to understand Renaissance power as it was both sort of expressed and displayed and manifested was all about these sort of light-emitting effects, which were, you know, seen or understood in skin tone, in hair, in particularly in display. Particularly in clothing and adornment. And this was a way that these sort of aristocratic bodies set themselves apart from, you know, what I very, you know, intentionally call lackluster bodies, right? That bodies that most of the people, at least in the 15th century, the vast majority of Renaissance of Italians could not afford metals or any sort of reflective materials in their clothing, and very often couldn't afford silk also, which is, you know, another very sort of reflective and shimmering textile. Very often they weren't even allowed, even if they could afford it, they weren't legally, because of some sumptuary laws, allowed to wear them, to display them. And they often used, you know, sort of very dull, very drab clothing that was brown, without using, you know, I always tell my students, we also need to think back, you know, and imagine a time when there weren't synthetic dyes, where pretty much any of us can buy a shirt of more or less any color. And we can assume that it'll probably, the color will remain after a number of washes, right? We need to think before synthetic dyes and think, you know, so think about the materiality of these dyes as well. And particularly reds and blacks were so expensive because they were so difficult to really remain in the clothes for long. And I should say, though, that, you know, that's kind of like the overarching framework here. But there's lots of, I think, exceptions to that rule, too. And we are finding, I think, particularly in the 16th century, though, that lots of people of maybe even the middling classes did, because of the secondhand trade in clothes, right? And all of these clothes were reused, recut, and once they, you know, and were passed down, that people of all different sorts might own a garment or two that was a little bit more colorful, a little bit more sort of splendid than we might think. But nevertheless, this was a way that rulers set themselves apart, right? Convince the people that they ruled that they deserved to be in power.
So I think it would be helpful for all of us to think about, for you to walk us through, you know, what are these men wearing? And, you know, one aspect of your book that interests me is the relationship between this brilliance and militarism. And we're going to talk some specifics here just to help out some of us who aren't historians. Like, because to the untrained eye, I have to say tunics, doublets, the little hose, they all seem pretty far from modern notions of masculinity and particularly military masculinity. So could you maybe walk us through, you know, what princely dress of the Quattrocento is and how it's and how much of it is what I've learned from your book is tied to military ethos?
Yeah, so a lot of the garments, you know, sort of in different ways derive from military garments. And I think, too, one of the things that I sort of realized about these princes is they very often sort of, I mean, their clothes are very metallic. So in, either in terms of brocades, they have lots of spangles hanging down. They wear components of armor. You know, the idea of a suit of armor is sort of an anachronistic one that was very, 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 very rarely worn. But these princes all the time were like hunks and chunks of armor here and there on their legs, or maybe just a cuirass on their upper body, or some kind of protective upper body garment. There are various different sorts, or even sort of just like jutting bits of metal to suggest that these men could carry a lance if they needed. Or very often, and you see this in some images, there's I think one that I reproduce is a portrait by Cosme Turin, the Met, where they have little hanging strings with on their shoulders. These are called arming points. With metal at the very end, sort of, it looks like a shoelace with metal at the end instead of plastic that you might be familiar with, and those are worn to tie armor to the upper body garments. But for a couple of decades in the period that I studied, particularly the 1460s, 1470s, these were worn by men even if they had no intention of wearing armor. You see them also in Andrea Mantegna's famous frescoes in Mantua. A number of the adult men and even like young boys are wearing these arming points.
I found that just that point interesting. It reminds me of modern day camouflage, where people are wearing camouflage, but they have no probable intention of going out into the woods and with, you know, in work.
Absolutely. And they're not hiding from anyone too, right? They're wearing their camouflage like conspicuously so
in
that
New
people
York
notice
City.
Them, right?
Right.
They're doing the opposite of what, you know, what camouflage should be used for.
So it's meant to recall militarism. And the same was with, maybe just to walk people through, I mean, I think we're all familiar with these paintings of men in what look like short skirts, but maybe you can explain with what that is, the doublet and the,
So what men of sort of, most men, not even just not, you know, a sort of all men in 15th century Italy would have worn some, maybe three layers of clothing, or maybe two if they were laborers, but ideally three. And the bottom layer would be some kind of linen shirt, camicia of some sort, or camisa of some sort, and then some kind of, mutande or linen underwear. Not only linen, but I think that's typical. And then above that, you would wear sort of like doublets and stockings, calze, and they are often hooked or tied to each other. Right, so the stockings, which in this period are not knit quite yet, but they're sort of they're attached up the back, sewn up the back, to really hold tight to the body, to fashion this sort of, I think what we'll talk about is this ideally slender silhouette. They had to be held up tight, and so they were laced to doublets. And you see this a lot if you're looking at Renaissance paintings. If you look around the waist, you'll see like little cords flapping around, or particularly if there isn't a long mantle worn on the outside layer or tunic, you see these, and they're really to sort of encase the body, but to hold the two garments in place, the upper body doublet and the lower body stockings or hose. And then above this, on the kind of outer layer, you would wear a garment that would, you know, generally keep you warm, but also this was an important garment, and the most important garment for one of the most important garments for display. And the sort of in Florence and in Venice, where there are republics that had, you know, these kind of ideologies of austerity and rule being passed down since time immemorial, so unchangeable fashion, there, it was important to wear kind of long garments that hid the body, right? And there are a number of types of garments that men would wear. And then if you're, the more important you were, the more sort of expensive your dye would be. So you see a lot of reds and blacks in those kind of ranks of somber men. But at the courts, you're more likely to wear a much shorter kind of tunic rather than a long, long mantle. And it can have all sorts of different attached sleeves, sometimes capes or other mantles behind them. Some of them came quite short, you know, well above the knees, as a way to show off kind of ideally beautiful male legs. Also, some of them were kind of very often tied tight with a belt. So the most common of these tunics that I see in my documents and that we see in a lot of Renaissance images are known as jornée. The jornée was a quite tight garment, tunic. But that's just sort of one of many different types of cuts of these sorts of garments. And then, of course, most of these aristocratic men would also wear a cap on top. And these hats would have different sorts of meanings inherent in them. And I think at the courts of Italy, they're very often, again, red or what they would have called crimson because of the expense of the dye. And then all of these levels or layers, at least the second and the third, could be infused with gems. We see lots of calze, for instance, lots of hose that have metallic emblems embroidered or have dozens of gems on them. And the same would be true for hats and for tunics as well, too. And even sort of doublets, particularly if the doublet would emerge from the tunic and you could see the sleeves, they might be embroidered or brocaded too, or they just might be a kind of plain silk or some kind of silk with a design like damask or like a more textural silk like velvet.
You know, you mentioned the long tunics of Venice and Florence republics, but then you also, I think in your book, you make a nice point of showing how this is sort of a fungible border between republics and courts as well. I mean, you would see the short tunics in the republics at times, and Lorenzo de' Medici even has a gift from, I believe you mentioned, from the Sforza family that, you know, of shorter tunics, and I can think of a few paintings with them as well. So it sounds like there's some, you can't draw distinct lines always, at least. Unless
absolutely.
I maybe misunderstood that. Okay.
Yeah. That's something I definitely try to, you know, take on in the introduction of my book. And you know, it has to do with, you know, youth and, you know, Florence and Venice. If you think of the Compagnie delle Calze, right, in Venice, where there's a moment for display of male bodies, and it's just for the youths in Florence and Venice. But then once you reach adulthood and you're part of the more officially part of the government, it's important that you sort of like don't show your body and you have this sense of, yeah, like I said, austerity and sobriety, which is very much reflected and sort of produced even by clothes.
And that may be different in the courts, because I was struck really by some of your images of older men in the short tunic with the hose. Yeah, that was actually pretty interesting. Moving on, like one of the themes that your book repeatedly demonstrates, one of the ones that really, you know, hits home for me, is that our modern notions of gender and dress are just not adequate for understanding the Quattrocento aristocratic men. And I think it's your chapter on gems that makes this point really in an unambiguous way. precious, maybe because precious stones in our own culture are almost exclusively associated with women. And, you know, that just doesn't seem to be the case in the Quattrocento, which I did know. But what I didn't know, and I found this detail so interesting, was that women and men would actually wear the exact same stone, particularly if it's a famous stone, on different occasions, on a maybe a cord around their neck or some other setting. So maybe you can talk about that, but also just the role of gems, be they real or manufactured, in creating this noble masculinity.
Absolutely. So I mean, you know, and I think it's when you ask the question, noble and masculinity, both of those words are just as important, right? And I try to set this out in a certain way. I mean, obviously, this is a book. I mean, the subtitle is Fashioning Courtly Men in Early Renaissance Italy, and it's very much about masculinity, but it's just as much about nobility. And everything that I'm saying here is, you know, arguing is just as sort of class or status specific as it is gender specific, right? And so sort of there are differences in display between noble, between elite genders here, but there are also a huge number of similarities, right? Both of these, both men and women of the aristocracy in early Renaissance Italy were expected to show their station by dressing in expensive, but also sort of light, light, intense garments, and also to be wearing studded with gems. But this was a sign of their nobility. There was nothing sort of suspicious in terms of, or very little suspicious in terms of their sort of their masculinity. We have examples of literally dozens and dozens of gems on calze. Some large sleeves that were worn by some of the Sforza princes would have had, again, literally hundreds of gems on them. They would have shown off and collected enormous brooches, formaggi, and other sorts of gold chains with large hanging gems as well. And these would have also, you know, been seen with a background of some kind of shimmering, often metallic, silk as well. So you can just imagine kind of, you know, and a lot of the, when people are describing some of these gems, this is what they talk about, that they're flashing, that they're almost like flamboyant. So these gems very often, because they were worth so much money, and they were associated with people. They were associated with the identity of their owners, and particularly when they were passed down or when they were traded. There are letters between, for instance, Lorenzo de' Medici and Galeazzo Maria Sforza, the Duke of Milan, trying to, you know, Galeazzo was begging for this one gem that he's heard about that he wants to have, and actually that he wants to give to his mistress, but that Lorenzo does not want to get rid of. And so some of these gems, particularly, this one gem that I trace, which probably is not in the portrait of Galeazzo Maria Sforza in the Uffizi, probably the most famous image of him by Pier del Pollaiuolo, but it might be, and one scholar thinks it is, but I was able to trace this gem down a number of different to a number of different owners over a number of different generations, and it was worn by men and by women, and in all cases it was a sign of aristocratic status. So it wasn't, you know, and it sometimes did have different a different kind of ligature or a different sort of setting on it, but it was so well known that it had a nickname, more or less. So these gems take on identities as they kind of move within families and even between families. And this wasn't necessarily rare. There were a number of other gems that have nicknames because sometimes they were engraved or they have some kind of particular visual property to them. But the other thing I wanted to say too is that, some readers might, or some listeners might be, you know, rolling their eyes a little bit. Well, you know, wasn't there any threat of unmanliness or effeminacy if you wore too many gems? And there are voices that emerge, and I think, you know, so it's important to kind of think about them. The only time any of these princes are criticized for wearing gems, there is when they're already the speaker, the person who's criticizing them, already has some reason to do so. And for instance, Pope Pius II did not get along with Borso, the Borso d'Este, the ruler of Ferrara, and he slandered him in lots of different ways throughout his Pius's commentaries. He was mainly upset that Borso wouldn't contribute to his crusade, but there were other reasons that for a while they had been close, but they had a falling out over Pius's plans for a crusade. So then he started criticizing Borso for being a little too vain and a little too just interested only in appearing magnificent rather than being magnificent. And the same thing, there's a Giovanni Pontano, a humanist, when he was in Naples, he had been connected with the Sforza court earlier, and he started criticizing Galeazzo for wearing fake gems. Galeazzo Maria Sforza, the Duke of Milan, after he had been assassinated, for wearing fake gems and not being a true lord. So it actually, most of these, most of the criticisms are about sort of like a moderate nobleness or inauthentic nobleness, but it's not necessarily because there's any sense that their masculinity was in doubt or their masculinity was problematic or suspicious in any way.
I found that point to be really, I don't know that the word shocking is right, but I maybe unexpected because I'm accustomed to seeing studies about female, I think for decades, we've had so much work done on women's dress and sumptuary laws and misogynistic writings about female vanity. And so I assumed that it would also seep through into men's display of splendor, but it doesn't seem to with these princes.
Well, and I've thought about this question and I had this question before, and I too wonder, those are just sort of not the sources that we have or that I've found, right? I can imagine that lots of these men's subjects would have been, upset with them for any number of reasons. And I think this is one of the main things I want to point out. And the case I want to make in these books is that we're seduced by all of this, but these were awful people. Right. And I sort of love these princes because they're the gift that keeps on giving, but they're just in terms of like their awfulness, but they are horrific, horrendous people. And I don't have any sympathy for them. And I imagine that a lot of their subjects would as well, but I don't have those kind of voices. The only critics I have really come from, from other humanists or, there absolutely were a number of times, particularly whenever anyone was sick or died, where the popular would fight back. So we do have some sense, that these princes were always ruling on kind of like a very, very, they're always skating on very, very thin ice. And this, how they displayed themselves, how they showed themselves as these splendid, shiny, noble men was the main tool of keeping power. So I imagine that there was a lot of sort of like, people upset with them and would have thought that they were kind of ridiculous and vain. And probably they would have understood that a lot of these gems were fake and, they would have connected that to some kind of fake, rule. But I would love to find more of those criticisms, which I'm sure are there. They're generally not voiced by the sort of like elite people producing, literature and
right. It's a matter of what sources are available to us. Maybe that the message that we get. But I will say, when you describe what they're wearing and them being awful people, they're awful people wearing like 50 pounds of stockings. And they must have been uncomfortable as well as awful.
Yeah, and they talk about this too. I think I have one example where this Sforza prince, when I think he's 12 or 14 or something like that, tears his doublet off at the dinner table because it's too tight and he can't eat. And his grandmother is there and she is not happy about this at all. She reports back to his father and his mother about how, because he was wearing this particularly nice garment when there was a visiting duke from France, actually. And so clearly these men were uncomfortable. There's a forensic pathologist at University of Pisa, Gino Fornaciari, and then an Antonio Fornaciari, a relation, who has studied some of the bodies, because a lot of these princes were embalmed. So Sigismondo Malatesta and Federico Gonzaga, and then some of the Neapolitan kings, their bodies have been exhumed and studied. And they do have lots of kind of like compressed bones from wearing armor, from hours and hours spent on horseback, all kinds of damage from swords as well too. So, you know, these men did suffer kind of a violent existence, part of which was because of the need to display the body and the need to be so sort of militaristically seen.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Well, that takes me to my next question, which is about bodies. So I found your chapter on men's bodies, which I think has some of this discussion about men's bones being compressed, also being very exciting, because what's so obvious to even the untrained eye are how many men's legs are on display. And you talk about this, how women's legs are hidden and men's legs are on display. But you also bring our attention to the slender figure that men were apparently eager to display as well. And I sort of find it interesting to think about this focus on men's body image. So I wanted you to share with the listeners this amazing story about Galeazzo Sforza's ill-fated Corazzina, and maybe help us understand how he and other men were preoccupied with their body image, and what was that idealized body that they were seeking to achieve.
Yeah, so I think it goes back to kind of what I was talking about with this, particularly with the doublet attached to the calze, producing the slender ideal. And most, if you were at rest, and you're a Renaissance prince or a courtier in the 15th century, you'd probably wear the third outer body tunic. But when you were, running around, showing, doing something where you had to show agility, you would take off that outer level. You would just wear your tunic and your doublet. But even with the third, and that's when you would really show off kind of like both how agile you were, how slender and lithe you are, right? And there was this ideal of a very, very kind of, slender figure. We see this also in 15th century sort of chivalric poetry. This is what also this the ideal that kind of emerges from descriptions of bodies and a lot of the correspondence between courts through the resident ambassadors, which are sort of a relatively new thing, a new phenomenon in 15th century Italy. And these men were obsessed with how they looked, both how they looked generally, but also their body image in ways that I think, is very familiar to us. They didn't sort of have the same language that we do, but they reflect the same concerns and also the same sort of like nasty discipline from others. So Ludovico Gonzaga, the main prince in Andrea Mantegna's frescoes in Mantegna, he talks about in letters to his son, who he thinks is overweight, about how when he was a small child, he was ridiculed by his father, and his father threatened to sort of demote him and to make his younger and more handsome and better shaped brother, Carlo, his younger brother, to make him his heir just because of how he looked. So he talks about how, and he says his dad called him a fat pig, just sort of like horrific things that I think, sound like the worst of middle school bullying today. I mean, he talks about how he just dieted and didn't sleep and drank water so that he could kind of get into shape. There are a lot of examples. I found a couple of examples of other Gonzaga family members insulting others, for being out of shape. But then the sort of most famous example of this that I kind of mentioned a couple times in the book is this the ruler of Milan, the Duke of Milan, Galeazzo Sforza, who is there are a number of towards he ends up being assassinated, and in the months before that there are a number of assassination attempts on his life. So he knows that he needs to be careful. He knows that he needs to protect himself, and he's surrounded by his. He has a number of bodyguards with him at all times. And this is, it's the day after Christmas, so the St. Stephen's Day. So he goes to church at the Church of Santo Stefano, which is at this time an important church in Milan, on this important Milanese feast day. And the day that he's about to go to church, he puts on a corazzina, a sort of like a, it's kind of like a bulletproof vest for the Renaissance, like a, an, so it could be worn over the doublet, it could be worn under it, but it very often is filled with, mail or nails or some kind of protective garment. It's not plate armor, but it's a textile that's infused with metal in some form to protect him. And according to a Sforza historian who was a one of his courtiers at the time, later on, about two decades later, he's writing, but he was there at the time, so it's hard to know if we can exactly trust him, the source, Bernardino Corio, that this is what happened. But it certainly reveals something about 15th century male, concern about bodily display and body image, with that he put on this corazzina when he was about to go to mass, and he took it off because he thought he looked too he looked too fat with it, wearing it.
An amazing story.
20-something times, and it wouldn't have saved his life probably, but nevertheless, he was. I call him a pseudo proto martyr for fashion, right? Also,
well, the fashion victim, like sort of on the nose. I'm so curious about this. I mean, there's some questions that come to mind that maybe we don't have time to get into, the difference that might exist with republics or in the court, or maybe what level in the hierarchy you have. I mean, so these are princes. I mean, is this true for the courtiers? And it seems, you do talk a lot about the courtiers and the sort of pressure on them to be young and handsome in certain courts. And the reason this comes to mind, of course, is the focus on female beauty. But I wonder, and this is unfair, I have an unfair question because you don't mention it in your book, but I am just curious if you've come across any sources here about the non-noble bodies. Are men showing off their legs, women hiding their legs? I'm sure we don't have a lot to go on in terms of their fears about body image, because there's probably not the sources there, but
this is a great question, and I would like to know more about it. I mean, it's still women very often. So it's in a certain way, I try to think about it in terms of maybe like cultural visibility, that of course, particularly in the lower classes, you would have seen body parts because people, would have been undressed some of the time or would have worn not as expensive clothes, but to preserve a sense of sort of decency. And just because of the way that fashion clothes at the time were cut, right, women hardly had legs. There aren't 15th century love poems that talk about women's legs. Women's are beautiful from the chest up, right? And I think, think of Petrarch. And then maybe also in the hands, right? And then sometimes they do often have kind of like shapely hips to give you a sense of also, relating to their sort of like ideal childbearing capabilities. But beautiful long legs that we hear in like ZZ Top and other sorts of 20th century manifestations. When you talk about slender, beautiful legs, they're always going to be male in the 15th century. And it's because, it's in a certain way, it's a chicken and the egg thing. And I think this is a question that fashion historians have, that how do societal ideals relate to cuts of clothes and how do they sort of influence each other and where is the influence coming from? Or are they sort of developing in conjunction, which I think is probably the case here. But at least to be, ideally decent, you wouldn't show this off. But even like, Jill Burke's recent book on the Italian Renaissance nude showed, one of the useful kind of takeaways from that, I think, very important study is that most people, even when they were considered to be nude, it was because they were missing one or two important garments. They weren't what we would consider to be, buck naked or entirely nude like that. Even the way that this was practiced, not in representation, but in just in everyday life. So that bodies weren't, I mean, of course they would have been available. People could see their own bodies and bodies of family members. And probably, you would have seen, I think, wretched bodies, right? Dead bodies more often, right? And, bodies that were sort of outside what was considered to, you know, what was the ideal. But for those that wanted to kind of fit in wherever they fit in society, it would have been, you would have seen a lot less flesh than I think we're used to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is that helpful or?
Yeah, no, it is helpful. It's just always so striking to me when I read a book like yours. Well, there aren't many books like yours, to be honest, and that's what's so great, is that all of these assumptions we have about female beauty, there's obviously in literary studies so much written in from the man's point of view about women's beauty. There, it's not that there aren't paeans to men's beauty as well. There are, but you know, we have a lot more to learn. Especially about bodies. I have to say the last chapter really struck me because it was, I wasn't expecting it, and so fascinating, which is on this, you have a study of clothing's role in the construction of nobility through whiteness and blondness. And it was such a welcome chapter because any person who teaches Italian literature has students who are always asking about the blonde women. And, you know, especially the Orlando Furioso, when you have the princess of, you know, China, Angelica, who's blonde, famously blonde as well, but also, you know, all the way from Petrarch onward, that there's just blonde women throughout Italian literature. And this is the first study I've seen to focus on blonde and pale men. So I would love for you to talk to us a little bit about how men cultivated the link between whiteness and nobility.
Yeah, so, I mean, in a certain way, it's going back to the same roots, right, of sort of chivalric ideals, that there is inherent kind of aristocratic status and essence in blondness and in paleness, right? And you know, and of course it relates to labor and status in different ways, right? These are blue bloods, you know, literally blue bloods, because you can see the blue veins in because they're so pale, that are not out in the fields, that are not out in the wind, right? That are soft and are fair, right? You know, like the fair princess. I call these men fair princes. And they are doing things like shielding their body from the skin with these very wide straw hats that you see in a couple of paintings by Pisanello, for instance, or in the frescoes of the Camera, the frescoes of the Salone de' Mezzi at Schifanoia. And men collected these hats to keep and traded them. I should say princes did. To keep the sun off their skin. It seems that they sometimes dyed their hair blonde. It's hard to know because, you know, a lot of the sources that we're using, both in terms of visual sources and literary sources, clearly are, you know, exaggerating at least, or completely fabricating things that, you know, sometimes, you know, Borso d'Este is described as having a face that shines more than the sun, and you know, and having golden locks like Apollo's. And he seems, at least, you know, in some of his early images, he does have blonde hair. Later on, he has gray hair in his images. It's hard to line up representation with reality. And we know that, you know, both artists and those who sort of like praise him both in letters and in poems would have been well served by turning him into this prince and into this chivalric, blonde, fair prince.
Well, the image you have of the Este male family tree, I don't know how else to put it. It's not really a tree, but maybe you just want to tell people what that image looks like. That was so striking. I mean,
yeah. So there's this Este genealogy that it's illuminated, and I think, you know, some of the pages they have nine figures on them. A number of the pages have nine figures, and essentially all of the princes are blonde, right? And this genealogy served it's a complicated story because the Este also they were passing their rule down to a number of bastards, essentially, and illegitimate sons. And towards the end, when it went from Leonello to Borso and then Borso to Ercole, there was Leonello's son who was in the mix and was passed over. So this manuscript constructs a a particular version of an Este lineage, but it's one in which Ercole essentially wants to show that all the people who were ruling before him were ideal princes, and it leads exactly to him. So if you want to show someone as the ideal prince, you show them as beautiful and blonde, whether or not they necessarily were, right? And if you want to, you know, praise someone for being the ideal prince, this is how you do that. But I also, in this chapter, wanted to think about how this relates to ideals of European whiteness, even white supremacy, emerging ideals about race at this time, where, particularly when Borso d'Este, for instance, was in the Palazzo Schifanoia, was, you know, putting himself against figures who were uncourtly in certain ways, including, figures who may have been of African descent, or certainly in figures who clearly were of lower classes and spent a lot of time in out in the fields, and were their bodies were worn because of those reasons. At the same time that there's an increasing number of black figures in black men and women in Europe, and there certainly had been. But I think this is an important part of the story. Also, particularly when the one of the rulers of Milan is known as Il Moro. Right. And because in Ludovico Moro Sforza, he had gotten that nickname from when he was born. There's a letter from his mother to his father, who's away, mentioning that he is darker than any of their other children. And so this was worn, obviously, as a sign of respect. This was not derogatory at all. So how does this fit into ideals about European whiteness and ideal noble fairness is something that I try to take on in this chapter too.
I think there's more questions probably than answers, but I know that it helps me think about the ubiquity of blonde women as well. And one of my favorite stories, which you didn't just mention, but I want to bring it up, is that the conflicting story about, you mentioned one source which talks about, I think, about a son that has blonde hair, and then there's another source that does not describe the son in blonde terms. Am I remembering this correctly?
I'm not exactly sure.
Anyway, there's all these, but I think, and you do talk about how Borso d'Este is described that way too.
There are times when, we can't believe a source. Yes.
Right. So, this moves us to the epilogue of the book, which is the 16th century mainly, but this where we see a trend of men wearing black. And, you know, most of us who are familiar with seeing portraits of Italian Renaissance men are used to seeing these men all in black. And I'm thinking, you know, how do we get from the flashy gold of the Quattrocento to the ubiquitous black dress in the Cinquecento? And, I'm going to ask, because I think you address this really well in your book, how this relates to the men's renunciation of fashion, which is what it's been called by other people.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's weird that the great male renunciation of fashion is something that I think we're all familiar with. It's clearly a phenomenon, but then also I guess like all kind of great historical narratives, there's a lot of untruth to it too, right? Just the idea. And there's been a good number of attempted explanations for why it is in the 16th, 17th, 18th century, men were no longer seen as peacocks. When men were wearing, grays and blacks only, right? And I have students understand, think about this today, and in corporate culture, what would happen if the CEO showed up in some of the colors that we see these Renaissance princes wearing, right? They wouldn't be taken seriously. Although, of course, there are certain increasingly, I think men are, both in terms of popular culture generally, like men can dress up more. So we're getting away from that. But black dress sort of came in. Scholars have liked to find a moment where it changed, and have associated it with the Industrial Revolution or the Protestant Reformation or the Wars of Italy, right? That you've written so much about. There's always, whenever you think you understand what happened, you'll find that there's a million exceptions to it as well. And they were 14th century princes wearing black. They were, of course, and one of the things that I think art historians repeat without really thinking about it is they just, when they see black clothing, they think it's Spanish because of sort of the mid to late 16th century Habsburg with Charles and Philip interest in black clothing. And they did eventually take that on. But Charles V, for instance, was wearing bright clothes in early in his life before that. And there were lots of Europeans that were wearing black who weren't Spanish. And in the 1490s, if you look at what Spanish dresses in Milan, for instance, it has nothing to do with black. It very often, it sometimes has to do with color, but it could be white. It very often has to do with like cuts of fabric as well too. So there isn't one overarching answer, but there is clearly, I think with the Wars of Italy is it does sort of bring this, usher this in. There's a sense of needing to sort of be more sober. But at the same time too, black clothing is extremely expensive. So particularly to be able to get the blacks that we see, it's many, many vats of dye, many, many different sort of ingredients. And then until the late 16th century, when logwood comes from what's now Belize in Mexico, and that sort of revolutionizes black clothing. Although that black then is very, very glossy and lustrous. So it still is a sign of expense. And it's something that the lower classes can't afford, even if they're, because their clothing was more likely to be much more kind of dull, even if it is drab and dark. It's nothing like the glossy black, which then the, you know, these lords understand is a perfect background for all their shiny things. So even most of the famously black 16th century Italian lords, when you look at what they wore black, but they wore pearls and little golden spangles too. So there's more continuity, I think, even with what I call the black is the new gold in the 16th century, that it still is all about prestige and even luster, but just shown in a different sort of way.
Yes, I loved that black is the new gold. It's hardly a renunciation of fashion. It seems to actually just be a new
continuation. Yes,
right. Especially when you read Castiglione's obsession with having the right cape or the right cloak. Even Ariosto will complain about not having the right clothing.
We should write an article: The Great Masculine Continuation of Fashion.
Exactly. Well, I wouldn't dare. You're the expert here.
We should. Okay.
Well, look, I mean, this has been great to talk to you. I've taken a lot of your time. I mean, do you want to tell us what you're working on now at the moment?
Sure. Well, I'm like this large project. I'm sort of just beginning, although it's beginning for a while, but kind of starts and stops is on the materiality of fashion. Sort of all the wars that were fought over dyes and mordants like logwood and cochineal and mordants like alum, that one of like the greatest atrocities of the 15th century Italy, the siege of Volterra, with lots of people killed and sacked, involving Lorenzo de' Medici and Federico Gonzaga, two of the great kind of, you know, Renaissance princes that we hold up as great enlightened patrons of the art, was took place because of the Voltairians had found alum, right? A mordant. A mordant is something that allows for these kind of dyes to literally to bite into, but to hold fast to textiles. So, I mean, I think that scholars have known that, you know, the economies of the Italian city-states in the Renaissance were so heavily related, you know, were driven by the production of clothing, from kind of raw materials to finished products. A future project on the materiality of the fashion, to not just look at kind of like the finished garments, but all the things that they came from, with a more kind of global look. So that's sort of more into the future and more immediately next year, hopefully. I have a book coming out, either 23 or 24, there's a book coming out with Reaction Press called Making the Renaissance Man, which in a certain way is kind of like a second part of this book. But instead of about clothing and adornment, it's about all of the things that these men did. They seduced mistresses, they seduced men and boys, they traded animals and were obsessed with falconing and hunting. and their dogs generally. They fought in jousts. They collected armor. I'm forgetting a couple of things, but it's mainly about the history of sort of like performance of maleness and masculine sexuality, again, at a kind of elite level.
What's the title again so we can look out for it?
I'm sorry?
What's the title again so we can look out for it?
Making the Renaissance Man.
Excellent.
Fantastic. Although now I think that maybe we should be Making Renaissance Men. I'm not sure, but it's in production right now.
Well, we won't hold you to it. The title, if you want to change. Well, Tim, this was great to talk to you, and I look forward to maybe doing this again when the new book comes out. So
I appreciate it, Gary. This has been fun. I feel like I've talked too much, but you asked some really good questions that have spurred me. So this was exciting.
Fantastic. All right. Thank you again.
Thank you.